something like what happened in 2008 happen again.
If you don't remember, Bear Stearns, we do.
Maybe we can contain this crisis. It turned out that they couldn't.
10 years ago, Wall Street almost collapsed our economy, and this body seems to have experienced sort of a collective amnesia. 10 years ago, look what happened to the economy, and today we're giving relief to so many of the largest banks in this country.
It could happen again because Wall Street and big banks generally are in the business still of borrowing short and lending long. As long as everybody doesn't want their money at the same time, the fractional banking system works just fine. But occasionally people freak out. They did in 1929, 1930. They did in, 2008. And when people freak out, they all want their money at the same time. They all go to the bank to get it. And guess what? It's not there.
These things can happen like that.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, this week turned out to be much of a sleeper. Not too much of anything happening in the markets, but by the end of the week, we were in negative territory with the Dow Jones Industrial Average down about 1.5% for the week. We had the S&P 500 down 1.25%. We're still in positive territory for the year, but it has been a sideways market. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in hour one will be Ari Wald from Oppenheimer. He says we're going through a time correction process. He also believes that we're still in a bull market and we will resume an upward trajectory of the stocks. And he's going to talk about some of the best sectors he thinks are going to lead this market going forward. Also joining me later on in the program will be Ralph Bullis, an independent geologist, as he takes a look at some of the problems in the gold sector, especially for the big companies replacing their reserves as their production has declined more than 40%. If there's any mining to take place in the future, according to Ralph, is probably going to be on Wall Street rather than in the ground. And of course, Chris Sheridan will be here to talk about what moved the markets. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, the Fed is supposed to meet again next week, where it's widely expected to raise rates for the sixth time now to 1.75%. Ever since we hit a bottom in the summer of 2016, long-term interest rates have steadily risen, but especially last fall where they rose sharply. And many experts believe a new bear market in bonds has begun. You have to realize the trillions that are parked in various bond fund safe havens are losing money and likely to lose even more. So as an investor, if you're heavily in bond funds, well, you're losing money. And we're going to examine the new bond bear market, what it means, what it looks like going forward, and what the new environment means for investors and what you can do. All of that coming up in the second hour on The Big Picture as a part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And first, we check on what has been going on Wall Street all of this week. The S&P 500 dropped 1.2%. The Dow was down 1.5%, and the NASDAQ was down 1%. So things looked a little weaker. And Chris Sheridan, host of FS Insider, is replacing Ryan Poplava just this week. He's irreplaceable, Chris. So, but you can fill in for
him. We all know that.
but we can fill in for him this week. All right. Things were a little weaker. Give us some details.
Most of the weakness is being attributed to further moves on tariffs. In an article released Thursday, the New York Times reported that Mr. Trump and his top trade advisors are readying a raft of actions to penalize China's theft of American intellectual property, including tariffs on at least $30 billion of annual Chinese imports. Trump also picked well-known financial and economic commentator Larry Kudlow as his top economic advisor this week, replacing Gary Cohn, who stepped down over disagreement with Trump on tariffs and other matters. Kudlow is a strong proponent of free trade, and he served in the Office of Management and Budget under Reagan. He's also very well known for his bad economic calls, repeatedly denying we were in a housing bubble in 2005 or that the U.S. economy was facing a recession in 2008. On the corporate side, Singapore-based Broadcom officially withdrew its $117 billion offer for Qualcomm after Trump blocked the deal, citing national security concerns given Qualcomm's dominant position in 5G, fifth-generation wireless technology. Economic data was fairly positive. U.S. filings for unemployment benefits fell for the third time in 4 weeks. They remain near their lowest level in 48 years. Also, small business optimism remains very strong. And consumer confidence also came in at a 14-year high, going back to 2004. That being said, if we look at the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now estimate for the first quarter, it has continued to decline from its high levels that we saw even just last month, around 4 and 5%. It's now down to 1.8%. So at this point, the outlook for economic growth this quarter is subdued. Next week, Wall Street's attention is going to be moving back to the Federal Reserve. They're going to have a two-day meeting. It concludes on Wednesday, and a quarter point hike is widely expected. That's going to bring us up to 1.5 to 1.75% on the Fed funds rate.
All right, Chris, as host of FS Insider, what were the subjects of conversation with your guest this week on the program?
Well, on Monday, we spoke with Jeffrey Hirsch at Stock Traders Almanac, and he said that his superboom forecast, which he originally gave, I think, in 2010, 2011, for 38,000 on the Dow, that's still in play. He doesn't think it's going to be a straight-up fashion like we saw in 2017 with the market. However, he's looking for some volatility this year with midterm elections. Also, we spoke with Urban Carmel at the Fat Pitch. He thinks inflation expectations are running too hot and that we should expect to see things cool off a little bit. He's not calling for an end of the bull market or an end of the U.S. economic expansion, but he did say expect some cooling. And we talked about a possible mean reversion in the bond market and some investment strategy. And then on Friday, Jim Poplava actually stepped in and did an interview with Jim Paulson, the chief investment strategist of the Leuchtold Group. And they talked about, you know, how to think strategically in a sideways market. Paulson is also looking for volatility this year. So he gave his thoughts and his outlook for the year moving forward for FS Insider listeners this week.
All right, Chris Sheridan, thank you for stepping in for Ryan Poplava. We'll see you on FS Insider during the week.
Interest rates are rising, and the Fed intends to raise interest rates even further. As rates rise, the value of your bond funds will fall. Are you prepared for the next bond bear market? It has been almost 36 years since we've seen the last, and there's a high probability that another bear market in bonds has just begun. Long-term interest rates have been rising steadily since last fall. It's time to think about protecting capital. That's where Financial Sense Advisors can help you. Protect capital by designing a customized portfolio that can provide you with predictable income. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Call us today.
So give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. As investment fiduciaries, we put your interest first. Let us help you design a portfolio that provides predictable income and protects your capital. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939 to let us help you design a portfolio providing predictable income and protecting your capital. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
There is plenty of capability in this country for corporations to invest. They've been cash rich throughout the recovery, and we've just made them cash richer with the fiscal policy we've enacted. But the problem is they've got to have an expectation that the recovery is going to last for several more years. You don't make a massive capital investment program if you think a recession looms not that too far down the road. And I think that's kind of the problem. The CEOs may well see a healthy economy at the moment, but they're also seeing interest rates going up, the money supply slowing, expectations that we're going to next year probably be close to the longest recovery ever in U.S. history. And they've got to be wondering whether it makes more sense to build a new plant or whether it just makes more sense to raise dividends and buy back stock. And you're already seeing more of the latter since the tax cut was passed rather than fresh new investment.
Well, it seemed like a great start to the year, as many say, as January goes the rest of the year. But the market has been, well, having a little bit of problems lately. Joining us on the program from Oppenheimer & Company is Ari Wald. Ari, we had a great start, and then we had that correction beginning in late January. We bounced back, but then we've been having difficulty holding. Is this, in your opinion, a nothing but a time consolidation before another catalyst moves it higher? Or could the markets be heading for some trouble here?
Our view would be the former, that we think this is a time correction. That's our view exactly here. If you look back at that drop in early February, the S&P 500 was down about 12% peak to trough over a 10-day period. If you look back historically, that was consistent with what you see in an average correction. In fact, the max annual drawdown on any given year on average has been right at about 11-12%. However, from a duration perspective, it was very brief, that historically these corrections do indeed tend to linger for longer than the 10 days that it took to drop in early February. So our take is that the subsequent backing and filling that we've seen in recent weeks is chewing up the necessary time for markets to firm ahead of the next leg higher. I think it's important to point out that the important support levels were held on that pullback, that the S&P 500 held its rising 200-day moving average. So our take is that the long-term uptrend is still in place, and with some of our indicators now setting back to more favorable levels, for instance, the put-call ratio showing high levels of put activity. From a contrarian perspective, when you see that type of pessimism in that indicator, it does indeed provide contrarian firepower, if you will, ahead that we think is going to help lead to the resumption of the longer-term uptrend once that catalyst is presented.
You know, for the longest time, almost a year and a half, it was like, I call it an escalator ride. The market was just steady rising. It continued to rise. It didn't matter what was happening in the world globally, economically. It just went up and we didn't get anything more than maybe a 2 or 3% correction. Ari, when you have something that takes place like we saw in January, is this a market that's transitioning to its next phase? In other words, we know that, for example, the Fed's going to raise interest rates likely maybe three times this year or more. We know that inflation is likely to heat up. We know that economic growth is supposed to pick up. Is this a market that is transitioning to that phase?
We do think the volatility, what that did mark, was a transition in this bull market. We do agree with that. I think what you referenced at first, that escalator higher, if you will, is characteristic of a very healthy, strong bull market. In fact, the kind of the what we were calling more early to mid-cycle phases of a bull market. And that's an important point, that we think the action looking back in 2015 and 2016 and that important market bottom in February 2016 when the S&P 500 was all the way down to around the 1800 level, that was consistent looking back through history with a non-recessionary bear market, that although the economy didn't reset, price action reset. And so since then, we've been making the case that where we've now completed the second year of a new bull market. Now, if you look back historically, these bull market cycles last about 3 years. So from that perspective, we think there's some left in the tank. We think we're probably entering that final year. But I do think that now becomes the point when the uptrend is going to start to moderate. Some of our momentum indicators peaked on that February pullback. I think there's a good chance that the participation in the market's going to become a little bit more narrow. But just because we're seeing some cracks, it doesn't mean the uptrend is ending. In fact, if you look back historically, momentum peaks up to a year ahead of final price action. So yes, we are entering that final phase of the bull market. We think it's going to make selection that much more important, but we do think the bull market is still intact.
So when you're saying that we're entering this final phase, characteristic of that final phase, as you just mentioned, is participation begins to narrow, and you usually see one or two groups or a particular sector tend to dominate most of the gains occur in that sector. And the reason I'm bringing that up, Ari, if you take a look at technology, when we've had a correction, has gone down the least. When we've recovered, it's gone up the most. So are we beginning to see that right now?
We are seeing that. I would broaden it out to more than just technology. At the same time, we've seen financials hold up very well during the initial downturn and do a lot better on the way back up. In general, it's really cyclical areas of the market that I think where you're going to see the flows go into. That on the other side of the equation, the groups that have weakened the most on the pullback, lagged on the way up, lagged on the way down, and now are lagging on the way back up again, are your more counter-cyclical safety sectors with high dividends. That interest rates have been the main driver of the rotations that we're seeing and a determinant of the areas that are holding up best and worst. And it's those with a higher dividend that act as a bond proxy that have been hardest hit. They've been the areas that have weakened in the credit markets, in the high yield markets the most. So that's where we see the risk. Those are the areas that we want to stay away from, when in fact, what gives us some encouragement that we do think this bull market continues is still this preference for cyclical areas of the market, technology, financials, industrials. I think it's very telling that the tech sector is already out to new highs while the rest of the market is still below where it was in January. That's a sign of relative strength. Some of these tech areas just getting above levels from 18 years ago. The semiconductor SOX index finally breaking above its all-time high last set in March of 2000. We think tech is a secular story. If we're in some sort of longer-term secular bull market, we think tech is a prime candidate, not only to lead for the rest of this cycle, for the coming months and quarters, but potentially for coming years as well. There's really 3 points that gives us conviction making that call. One, how broadly strong the tech sector has been. It's not just FANG stocks. It's across capitalizations, mid caps, small caps, across the world. It's been emerging market tech, across industries as well, software, internet, semiconductors, IT services. Point two would be is just the steady nature of the advance as well. It hasn't been as, you know, parabolically higher as it was in the late 1990s. It's been a much more steady rise. And point three, why we're bullish on tech and why we think it continue to lead the market higher, is that it has shown this resiliency to fluctuating interest rates and commodity prices, which have been the key drivers of sector rotations in recent years. Tech has been able to outperform whether interest rates are moving higher and lower. It's shown this all-weather leadership, if you will. We like that. We like the zero correlation to those factors. So you, when you add it all up, tech for us still remains a very attractive risk-reward bet.
So when you look at this and you're saying we're entering the final phase where the participation drops, you have fewer sectors doing well, as you mentioned, tech, financials, maybe industrials. Can this be misleading for your average investor? Because I think back to the peaking of the market in 2007 and in 2000. At the index level, if you're in index funds, the market is going up. But underneath it, it's mainly the generals, the strong, larger cap stocks that drive the index up, where the vast majority of stocks begin to roll over. Is there a risk there for the average investor?
It could become a risk. I mean, of course, we're making the case that this could potentially be the point where participation narrows. I would make the case we really haven't seen that just yet. I mean, as of January, when the market last peaked, I mean, keep in mind, this was only about 6 weeks ago, pretty much every major market average was at a new all-time high. The S&P 500, the Russell 2000, the transports, the NASDAQ, global benchmarks, emerging markets. Historically, indeed, when you do see breadth starts to narrow, it does mark some potential problems for the overall equity environment, and the average investor gets left behind if they're not in the right areas of the market. I don't think we've seen that just yet. Historically, breadth does tend to peak up to 5 months ahead of the overall market, so it will be important if the S&P 500 rallies back to new highs. Do those other key market averages rally with it? We still think you can see that. The Russell 2000 really within spitting distance of a new all-time high here. The Russell 2000 is a gauge of small cap stocks, more or less what the average stock is doing. You could even use the value line index to gauge that as well. The average stock is still doing well, I would say, participating in this bull market. The value line arithmetic index, it's an equally weighted gauge of 1,700 stocks, just getting above levels from 1998, a secular breakout for the average stock. So while we're on the lookout for what that would give us concern if we see participation narrow, and that volatility could be that catalyst from early February, I don't think we've seen it just yet, Jim.
All right, let's talk about other sectors of the market. Let's take a look at interest rates, because if this bull market does come to an end, it'll probably be preceded by Fed rate hikes, which is 11 out of the 12 recessions have been caused or been preceded by Fed rate raises. Let's talk about interest rates right now. They were sort of plateaued around 2% last September and almost hit 3%. What's your take on interest rates here?
Our take on interest rates are that they're moving higher, that we think the 10-year could reach 3.05%, which has been our call. We're getting increasingly closer there, and I think even potentially higher. Our view is that this could actually be a good environment for stocks, that it's not so much when the Fed tightens. It's when they tighten enough for the yield curve to invert. And it's the inversion in the yield curve that's been your more reliable recessionary indicator. And we're not there yet. And it's the inversion in the yield curve that has preceded every economic recession over the last 40 years. The act of getting to that inverted yield curve, historically, markets have performed very well in that environment. In fact, in one of the studies we've done, we've made the case that this has actually been the best period for the stock market heading into inversion. And even looking at 2006 as a roadmap, you had Fed tightening, you had the curve flattening, but it wasn't until not only till the curve inverted, but it was when the Fed actually started to cut interest rates, when you had directionally lower interest rates that coincided with the top in the market in 2007. It was directionally lower interest rates that coincided with the top in the market in the year 2000 as well. So for us, the direction of interest rates just as important as the level of interest rates. And for us, low and rising, bullish for stocks, bullish for cyclicals, bullish for financials. We think that's the environment that you're in. If you're worried about rising interest rates, the areas you don't want to be in are your more safety areas, consumer staples, utilities, REITs. And again, they've been the areas that have been weakest in the market and weighing most on some of our internal breadth gauges.
All right. Towards the end of the cycle, the Fed is raising interest rates. Inflation generally tends to pick up. Let's talk about inflation in inflationary type assets. And I wanted to move on, Ari, to the oil markets and the gold market right now. What's your take when you look at the commodity sector, whether it's the CRB, whether it's ags, whether it's oil, energy, or even the precious metals?
Looking at the commodity markets, the CRB, we're of the view that we are in a secular non-bull market. Well, what does that mean? Well, essentially means we're in a very long-term range in terms of commodity prices. Very similar to the long-term ranges that commodity prices were in the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1980s and 1990s as well. I think within that range, the upswing is higher. We think the weak dollar that we've seen due to the inverse correlation is providing a floor for commodity prices. And you can, I think at least from a trading basis, you can continue to see higher prices. But I think as a proxy for inflation, what it's created, this trading range environment, is this not too hot, not too cold environment. And for us, that is the ideal setup for equity prices. If you look back at those prior regimes of range-bound commodity prices, again, the 1950s and 1960s and 1980s and 1990s, also coincided with secular strength in the stock market. So again, making the case that we're in this longer-term bull market for stocks and the action and commodity prices is supporting that, not too hot, not too cold inflation here. What's interesting is that that hasn't been the area of the equity market you wanted to be invested in. I mean, here's an amazing stat. The price of oil is up roughly 150% over the last 2 years since it hit bottom in February of 2016 when West Texas was at $26. Through that 150% rise, in the price of oil, the energy sector has actually underperformed versus the market. That's the market telling us something. That's a market message right there. We just want to be a little bit more selective underneath the surface. I think looking at energy and some of these commodity-exposed sectors from an equity basis, it's been a much more of a mixed bag. It's not that we're cautious on them. It's just that I think you want to be more selective, placing the emphasis on stock selection rather than the overall group, which has had a tougher time over that two-year period.
And perhaps is this one reason why, Ari, if you take a look at whether it's looking at the price of energy, you look at the energy stocks, they've lagged the commodity. If you look at the price of gold, the gold stocks have lagged the commodity. Is that sort of a confirmation of that?
That's what we're picking up. You know, we pose the question like this. If these equities have underperformed through a rise in the commodity prices, what are they going to look like when the commodity actually falls and goes the other way? So again, right, you're not seeing the same reflection in the equity market as far as the areas you would expect to see do well against those rising commodity prices. I think what the equity market is sniffing out, again, is that these are kind of more of a trading assets at this point. It's a longer term trading range for these commodity prices. It's not going to be the trending environment that it was in the prior decade.
So given where we are right now, you believe that we have a time correction going on in the market. You think that this is the final phase, but we have a ways to go. As an investor, what would you be doing?
As an investor, I would be investing as if this was still an intact bull market, that we think that this final phase could last up to a year, potentially more. And I want to be exposed to the sectors most likely to outperform in a rising market environment, those with more cyclical attributes. For us, our top three sectors are technology, financials, and industrials. I think what all three of those sectors have in common is how broadly strong they've been. It hasn't just been led by one industry. It's really all the industries within those sectors have been acting strong. That's where I would be putting money to work right here in anticipation for a resumption of the uptrend. I want to own technology, financials, and industrials.
All right. Well, listen, Ari, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so.
They could follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Ari Wall.
Everyone loves the stock market when it's going up. Making money in the markets, when you think about it, seems easy, which it is when you're in the middle of a bull market. But stocks, as you well know, don't always go up. And there are times when they can go down, in fact, go down a lot, which is why you need to have an investment strategy to help you navigate the good times along with the bad. Not everyone has an investment strategy, and quite honestly, many of you don't. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. We can put together an investment strategy to help you navigate those volatile investment markets in good times and bull markets and the bear markets that follow.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. There's too much to fit in a weekend financial program. That's why we do a daily version of the Financial Sense News Hour, just like this weekday show.
I think the secular bull market began in February 2016, and it all fits in with my super boom forecast for Dow, 38,820 by the year 2025, which I put out in 2010 with the Dow about 10,000. We thought it was a bit incredulous at the time, and now it seems to make quite a bit more sense. So there'll be a few bumps along the road, but I think that anniversary in 2009, March, the low, and how far we've come is a testament to the fact that I think we've finally entered a new secular bull market.
Well, the price of gold has been struggling to get up over 1400. It's still positive for the year, just barely. But one thing that has stood out is the gold stocks aren't doing as well is the precious metals themselves. Let's look into the issue. Joining me on the program is independent geologist Ralph Bullis. Ralph, I want to go back to something that you presented a number of years ago in the last decade, and it was about gold discoveries made in the world. We weren't finding any major gold discoveries. In other words, the elephants pretty much had been found. I want to go back to that paper, and I wonder if you might just update us from what you were discovering back in 2005 compared to where we are today with gold discoveries.
Well, sure, Jim. And I think the earlier paper, the 2005 paper that was presented at PDAC, had a basic thought, I guess, that statistically, these very large gold deposits really are few in number. It's not to say that we're not going to find them again, but they are statistically few in number in nature. And the problem that I portrayed in my paper for what I call the very large gold producers, which I said were specialist gold producers with more than 5 million ounces production a year, they just weren't going to be able to find sufficiently large or sufficient numbers of gold deposits to replace those 5 million ounces every year. So they were going to have a problem from that perspective.
So if they're not able to find, and it's almost equivalent to what we've seen in the oil field, where, you know, they're not finding ANWRs anymore, or they're not finding a GARWAR field. So the fields are much smaller. What does that imply for exploration? And what does that imply for companies trying to replace their reserves or maintain their production levels?
Well, it's a real conundrum, because unless you're extremely lucky and happen upon one of these very large multi-million ounce deposits. At one point, Barrick was producing at over 9 million ounces a year. And to me, back then, clearly, it was going to be virtually impossible for them to find enough multi-million ounce deposits year after year. We're talking year after year to maintain that 9 million ounce annual production. So the conundrum then for the gold producers is, in order to replace that, you either have to find it, find those deposits through your own efforts, in other words, through exploration, or you have to be prepared to purchase those deposits, or the companies that find those deposits, provided they do, be prepared to make that capital expenditure by those companies. So you have a two-pronged attack, I guess, if you want to think of it those terms, buy your reserves or find them.
And that brings up the question, with not a lot of money being expended for exploration, at least from what I've seen, a lot of these companies have cut back during the downturn. Are they ramping that up right now? Or is what these companies plan on doing is maybe the best place to mine for ounces is on Wall Street?
Well, you know, gold price, of course, as you well know, that's a big factor in creating excitement. And it, as the price of gold goes up and more investors are encouraged to make those investments in juniors and let them provide the funding to let them go out and find those deposits. And we've come through a period of time, as you know, that gold has kind of been in the doldrums. But I was at the PDAC a couple of weeks ago in Toronto, and I have to say that the excitement was significantly higher there, I think, than it has been in past years. Certainly the numbers were up and the enthusiasm was almost palpable. So if that continues to hold, then I would expect that exploration efforts are going to increase over the next couple of years at least.
So as you're looking, you know, as you recently presented here at PDAC, your conclusions were multi-million ounce deposits are rare and expensive to delineate, and they're going to find replacing their production. In fact, Ralph, if I can just talk about here, you list some statistics. For example, Barrick's production is down 40% from its peak. Newmont's down 40%. AngloGold Ashanti is down 40%. So is this one reason, I guess, as you take a look at the price of gold, and more recently, since gold began to take off in December of last year, the gold stocks have not kept up with the price of the metals. Is this a realization by investors that despite the increase in gold, it's not going to mean more gold production and more profits, like, for example, what we've seen in the oil industry with the shale plays? We've seen American oil production increase, and the largest it's ever been.
Well, that's a really good observation and question, Jim. And one of the conundrums, as I was doing this update for this updated paper that I've just finished, while the price of gold has firmed or even climbed, the market capitalizations of the major gold companies, these very large gold producers, have actually kept on going down. Honestly, I really don't have a good answer for that. You know, there must be several factors at work here. Certainly, Perhaps gold is not as attractive now as it used to be. I mean, we've got all kinds of other strange things going on, like cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and lots of internet stuff. And now up in Canada, my goodness, we've got marijuana stocks if you want to buy that. So there's maybe more opportunities or choices for investors to make. And maybe gold is just going to be in the doldrums for a while longer until people get excited about gold again.
And Ralph, what about the technology of the industry itself? I mean, American oil production has been in steady decline since 1971. And then all of a sudden comes horizontal drilling, fracking, and here we are producing more than what we did almost 40 years ago. Is there anything like that on the technology front that would allow producers to mine more ounces of gold out of a ton of each deposit?
That's an attractive thought, and I'd like to say that there is for sure. But I think in terms of major technological breakthroughs, I mean, I think the last really significant technological breakthrough we had in gold mining was probably back in the 50s and 60s when we started to heap leach. And that opened up enormous deposits of very low-grade material that hadn't been viable prior to that time. And to me, in my mind, that's kind of analogous to what the fracking technology is doing for oil and gas. In the mining business, gold mining, well, metal mining as well, we've seen incremental improvements in productivities all along as our practices and procedures and mining methods have adapted and changed to increase productivities, lower costs, and thereby make some of the even lower grades economic. But, you know, we're producing such low grades now. When I was with Echo Bay, we were operating the Round Mountain deposit in Nevada, and their grades there were significantly lower than a gram of gold per ton. And so once you get down in the realm of 0.5 grams per ton to a gram per ton, you're going to have really significant improvements in productivity or a higher price of significantly higher price of gold before you can go any lower than that. So I guess the short answer is no, I don't think there is right now sort of a breakthrough technology. You know, I guess in terms of another aspect to it, we are finding that other areas, other geographical areas are possibly beginning to open up. I'm thinking of these hot spring deposits on the ocean floor that are possibly becoming economically available, if you want, or technologically available. That might be one area where you might see an increase over the years. But other than that, technologically, I don't think there is a breakthrough that I'm aware of anyway.
Let's talk about something else that is inhibiting a lot of gold production, and that is the length and amount of time from discovery, punching a hole in the ground and discovering gold to the time that gold actually gets mined and put into production. That seems to be lengthening. You have all kinds of environmental issues that companies have to deal with today. You have countries in many ways sometimes will inhibit or prevent or try to stop mining in some cases. What does that look like today? And how does that play a factor in terms of future gold production?
Well, that is becoming a real concern in the industry. And I think if you look at the presentation that I made at PDAC, there was one graph that's not mine. It's taken from another paper. But it suggests that the length of time from discovering a deposit to actually mining a deposit, you know, in the 1980s, 1990s was somewhere around 5 to 8 years. You know, now it's looking like 25 to 30 years. And a lot of these large gold deposits, as you know, they're upwards of $1 billion to put into production, the really big ones. And even the small ones, we're looking at probably $200 to $300 million. And to think of tying up that capital for 15 to 20 years or more while these things are being permitted and constructed, to me, is a significant inhibition to investors. And I've been in this business now for over 40 years in the gold business and the mining and exploration, and it's just gotten progressively worse. The regulations are getting tighter and tighter, but the regulations are being prompted and pushed by, in many cases, environmental activists that, and if I could be quite blunt about it, because I've dealt with these groups face-to-face across the table, and I can tell you quite frankly that not all of them, but many of them, have the ultimate objective of not sustainable development, but no development at all. And unfortunately, a lot of these groups are well-funded and have high contacts in politics. And so the end result for the mining business, at least in North America and in some of the developing countries, they haven't got to this point yet, but the regulatory hurdles are such that it becomes virtually, not impossible, but very, very difficult. And that's not to say that I'm advocating sort of a rape and pillage approach to mining. You know, we in North America especially, we have the most responsible mining environment in the world. And we can mine safely and cleanly, and our reclamation is second to none. But that doesn't seem to be enough. And that is a concern, because ultimately, if you can't build a mine in 30 years, then, you know, the investment is just going to dry up. And I have to tell you that, in my opinion anyway, that is the ultimate goal of a lot of these protests and a lot of these environmental NGOs.
If that's the case, I mean, you take a look at anything that we do today, whether it's manufacturing a car, an airplane or something, it all comes from ore that's taken out of the ground. So, I mean, what does this do to, in the long run, Ralph, to drive up the cost of making anything?
Well, of course, it's going to drive it. The cost of everything is going to go higher. And it's true that, you know, everything we use, and to me, the paradox is that, you know, all of this newfangled stuff that we're using, all the digital devices that we love so much, are increasingly dependent on fresh materials out of the ground, rare earths, and in a lot of cases, even gold in some of the circuitry. So that need is not going to go away. In fact, from all the surveys I've seen, that need is going to increase. So we're going to have to increase our metal production. And so what's going to happen, I'm afraid, is that we're going to see production coming out of countries where the regulations aren't as good as here in North America. And that is not going to be good for the environment. I'm all for responsible development and exploitation of these deposits, but it has to be done. I mean, otherwise we'll, you know, we won't be driving cars and we won't be having computers and we won't be making this phone call.
Let's talk about gold production in general. At one time, South Africa was the largest gold producer. I believe that's not the case anymore. And then there's China. And who are the large gold producing countries left? And the reason I'm bringing this up is depending on where you're mining for gold, it becomes more difficult. For example, here in the U.S., there's long delays to get a mine into completion. And a lot of the mines that are in production today have been in production for quite some time. So who are the big producers now as a country when it comes to the production of gold?
Well, you know, as I was doing this paper, one of the real surprises, because I hadn't really been tracking China, but one of the real surprises was to see how the production in China, gold production we're talking here, has increased over the last 10 years or so. It's remarkable. And at the same time, the gold production coming out of South Africa has gone down also significantly. You know, I can understand the difficulties in South Africa as the deposits get deeper and deeper and the costs go up and the extraction just becomes just more difficult. But what caught me by surprise was how much production was coming out of China. But China's not the only one that's increasing their production. There's increased production coming out of Australia. Russia is showing a real increase in its gold production. And while I was doing the research for this new paper, Jim, one of the things I discovered was that trying to get good, solid information out of China is extremely difficult. And I guess that shouldn't be too surprising, since a lot of the companies there, I suspect, are either state-owned or state-sponsored, and we just don't have access to the information that we do in publicly traded companies that are traded in North America and Europe. You know, you have shareholders and stakeholders that you have to be more transparent. So I don't know if the production in China is going to maintain its trajectory, which is impressive. But I will say one thing about future production, global production. I've actually done work in Russian Far East, and we've looked at, Equibe looked at several projects over there, quite a number of properties. And there are a lot of properties, probably dozens of properties, that are million ounce plus, that are basically just sitting, waiting for development. And if the 10-year situation could be firmed up in Russia so that you have solid tenure to your project, then that's certainly a possibility for more gold production.
So when you take a look at this, it's taking longer to bring a mine into production, number one. Number two, they're not finding major elephant finds out there, although there's some possibilities with maybe ocean exploration. And the big companies, whether you're looking at Barrick, you know, the top 10 companies, they're not replacing their reserves, and the production levels are down about 40-50%. So, Ralph, is the real play in gold mining going to be then in the exploration companies like the juniors. I know you do a lot of consulting for them, because if the big guys aren't finding it, it's usually, at least like in the last decade, a lot of the exploration was done at the junior level, but a lot of juniors got decimated in the gold downturn and not a lot of them around as much as, let's say, if we were looking back maybe 10 years ago.
Well, that's true, and that's a bit of a paradox as well. And if you take a look at the information in that presentation I made down at PDAC, you'll see that the very large gold producers, in fact, have slowed down their exploration spending significantly. And exploration for mining, as you know, is kind of like R&D in some of the other scientists and manufacturing fields. That it's your research and development. And if you don't do research and development and you're an Apple or a Microsoft, then, you know, your products are just going to dry up. And that's a good analogy to mining and exploration. If you don't spend money on exploration, then you're not going to find anything. So, you know, I've had several conversations during the course of making this paper with other colleagues and other geologists and exploration people. And one comment that comes up all the time is that, well, you know, as long as the exploration is being done, whether it's by mid-size or junior exploration companies, then the majors, the big guys, the very large gold producers can sort of sit by on the sidelines and get ready to grab something as the discovery is made. But of course, that presupposes that the mid-sized and the small guys are going to be funded. And as you point out, that's become a real difficulty. I know a couple of my clients have really struggled in the past 5 or 10 years just trying to raise money, and they've had some pretty good projects. So I guess looking on the hopeful side, you know, maybe the glass is half full, that people will become investors, will get turned back on to gold again and start putting money into some of these smaller companies that have some decent plays in some of the burgeoning gold fields. Then it's a matter of which one do you pick. And then, again, keep in mind that the majors are going to be sitting on the sidelines just kind of waiting to pounce if a new discovery gets made. And, I mean, that's good news for the investor, I guess. But that's the way I see it anyway, is that, you know, we're just going to have to wait until these juniors get back in action again and get digging, because the majors are not.
And finally, Ralph, as you take a look at deposits around the world and discoveries and the way things are going, in your opinion, have we reached peak gold? Are we getting close to it? Or have we actually gone and it's already arrived?
Yeah, that's a good question. That everybody wants to know that. And when I did my paper back in 2003, 2005, you know, there were some very, very good experts in the field that were saying, yeah, we've reached peak gold. In fact, we've come off peak gold. And, you know, here we are 10 years plus down the road, and we're producing more gold than we ever have. In fact, you know, the numbers have just come out from 2017, and we've actually produced more than 50 tons globally, more gold than in 2016. So, you know, we're still ramping up. Obviously, we're going to have to plateau somewhere. You know, nothing goes up forever. But somebody once said it's really hard to predict, especially the future. So I'm going to say that the chances of it going up a little bit are good. That's global production. But at some point along the way, we're going to have to level out. But I guess if I had to make a prediction, I'd say that the way things are going, as long as the gold price holds up, we're probably going to be producing globally as much gold as we are now for the foreseeable future. So that's probably 5 to 15 years.
Well, it seems to me, just reading your papers and just watching the gold market and what's going on with the big producers, it seems like if you want to mine for gold, maybe the best place to do that is on Wall Street. Ralph, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, how could they do so, please?
If they wanted to contact me, probably the best way to do it initially anyway is through email. And I can give you my email address if you like. And that's rbullis@telus.net.
The Fed is going to meet again next week, where it is widely expected they will raise interest rates for the sixth time, this time to 1.75%. That's the expectation. And ever since we hit a bottom in summer of 2016, long-term interest rates have steadily risen, and risen sharply, especially since last fall. Many experts believe that a new bear market in bonds has begun. So if you are an investor who is in the bond market or bond ETFs, what does that mean for you? And what can you do in this environment? That's the subject for The Big Picture coming up next on the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.